Like, I used to always think that visual effects compositing was like a magic trick, right? Like, I would always try and do the effect shot before it got to the effect shot. So by the time it got to the effect shot, you couldn't tell what was going on because we'd already done it. One of the great jobs that a visual effects supervisor or a lead comp does is look at something and try and work out what's going to be hard, what's going to be easy, what are the best ways forward, just like imagining it ahead, right? And so when you get a new tech comes along and someone's like, how long is this going to take? And you go, I think it's going to be X. And you go, actually, when I got into it, it was throwing up complete curveballs that I hadn't imagined. We've come up with this clever idea with machine learning, and it seems to me like this will work like really, really well. And it seems like so obvious, like, hasn't somebody done this already? And like, it's kind of just genius. And won't that be exactly what you want? And isn't this like a perfect candidate? And Andrew goes, oh yeah, we're in the popcorn era. And I'm like, I'm sorry, what? And he's like, yeah, there are all these kernels that are going to pop. They just haven't popped yet, right?
This week on the VFX Artist Podcast, we have Mike Seymour, who is arguably the first one to do a VFX podcast. Back in the day, VFX Guide, which is still going, and I think it's still like top ranking podcast in our sector. And also, you've got you've come to talk specifically about, I know, AI, and but you know, it's great to catch up generally. I myself actually got into the industry via FX PhD, which you and John founded. So for me, this is a big honor. So I'm very proud to have you on the show.
Well, thanks so much, Daniel, and it's really great to be here. Thank you.
So we've got a bit of a time difference. It's Friday night here in London, and it's 7:30 in the morning in Sydney.
Absolutely,
but that won't stop us. Well, tell us a bit about yourself, Mike, because actually, I mean, I know from FX PhD days, but not everyone kind of knows what you do and how you got into the industry and the kind of things you've done, because you've obviously, it's quite a lot of things.
If you go right back, I did computer science back in the day because I was an independent filmmaker. Like, I'd got, you know, government film commission kind of grants to make films. And I was like, yeah, I kind of post-production had more interest to me than in front of the camera or even around the camera. And I was also thinking, and then anyway, being of that Star Wars generation that just fell in love with visual effects, I decided to study computers at university. And that led me into an R&D company, which led me to London and to Hollywood. So I worked there for a while. And then I came back. And at that time, when everything was being digitized and becoming digital, the hottest areas weren't feature films for the digital crowd. They initially were things like television and commercials. So if you go to Los Angeles, for example, the cool stuff that was happening in the digitization of visual effects was first happening in programs like Star Trek The Next Generation because they were standard def and not film res. And in fact, ILM, while obviously a leader and one of the greatest companies ever in visual effects, you know, was actually kind of a notch behind, especially in compositing, because they were doing still great optical stuff. And so it was really hot to be doing stuff in digital. So in my case in Sydney, I was doing stuff in commercials a lot. So I did that for a while. They had good budgets and loads of fun. And I ended up putting in the first Flame in Sydney and Flint and setting all that kind of stuff up. So we're doing a lot of that work. And that's exactly where I met my business partners, Jeff and John. And we set up FX Guide in 99. I know that makes me old. And the point about it was we were like really high paid Flame artists, and we would sit in the suite and clients would come in and, you know, we were go on set and be VFX soups. But the trouble was they'd walk into the room and they'd say, hey, Mike, like, I've seen this amazing new technique. Like, how do you do that? And I always wanted to say to them, well, how the screw would I know? Like, I'm never allowed out of this room, right? Like, the charge out rate's really high. The last thing the company's letting me do is like stop working and read anything. And it struck John and I and Jeff that was a common problem, right? That you had all of these senior compositors and everybody expected us to know how everything worked, but we never had any time to learn. And so we set up FX Guide just as a kind of a way for artists to help other artists. That spawned, you know, it's exactly what we're doing still today with FX Guide. Along that path, unfortunately, we lost Jeff to cancer. And so it just remains with John and I. But it's the same principles applied. And at some point, we decided that the helping younger artists or sort of less experienced artists was a really great idea. And so we set up FX PhD. And I guess today, most of my focus, I continued doing stuff, but I ended up actually hitting university fairly hard. Like, I'd done my undergraduate on computer science and pure maths. I'd gone back because I started running a company with like 100 staff, and I was like, oh my God, this is like quite a lot of work. So I did an MBA to kind of know how to run the company, which was so bizarre because I was the only person from the film industry. And every time they had an assignment, I'd like, can I do that about like visual effects? And they're like, you're what? but I needed to understand how to, you know, run a company, because the people side of things was like super important to me. Anyway, and then I went rather well in that, and they invited me to do a PhD, and I sort of put a pin in it for a while. But after a while, I decided that I was having so much fun doing this kind of training and consulting work that I'd actually go back and do my PhD. And so now I have a research lab at the University of Sydney, and I continue to do sort of stuff that I did before, but in the sort of more rigorous world of academia. So I still teach, I consult, and of course I research stuff, but I'm obviously a lot less on productions, or at least you'd think I am. That research spawns a lot of industry partnerships. So unlike some academics that are kind of writing sort of theoretical stuff, I do what's called engaged research. So you might be a company that is looking, like I had one case of a company looking at doing complicated metaverse digital twin stuff, and I got involved with them as a consultant. In another case, I was doing stuff for Warner Brothers or Illumination Studios, like the Minions. And most recently, because my whole area of specialty is digital humans, and I did a lot of work with sort of what you call CG digital humans, like model it, texture it, light it, and render it. I then spawned or kind of went in parallel doing neural rendering and AI. And so I started the neural rendering AI in sort of 99, and I guess I was ahead of the curve in that respect. But we did a lot of machine learning, a lot of complicated stuff. And a good example of that is with a film called The Champion. So Adapt Entertainment was looking to solve a problem of dubbing. Now, dubbing is a huge problem, right? But Adapt goes, how could we solve this? And they spoke to some people and they said, oh, you should talk to Mike. And I helped put together a plan of how to change that whole pipeline of dubbing. And so we can talk about it later. But so we basically converted an entire film using machine learning a year and a half ago now. And converted an entire film from looking like it was done in Polish and German to looking like every actor had been filmed in English, as if they were 100% just shot in English.
Dubbing is a big issue. I remember I lived in Italy for a long time, about 8 years, and they dub everything because they, well, for various reasons, but they, you would watch a movie dubbed, and it's really horrible to watch. And of course, if you're a Westerner, your more likely experience of watching dub shows will be Netflix nowadays. And if you're probably our age or older, it will be Kung Fu movies. But the potential of AI to solve the dubbing problem and solve the lip sync problem is quite impressive.
Yeah, certainly we find it to be a really interesting area. And it's actually one that ties in at a number of levels to do with AI, I think. One of the things that we really try and do is be respectful to the people that are involved in the process. So let me give you an example. Like, if you have a film that you want to dub into another language, you have only at the moment, well, you had two options, you now have three. The first one is to put subtitles up, right? And the second is to dub, as in to just have somebody else voice to the existing vision. And then the third, of course, is our new approach where we actually fundamentally change the face of each actor. Okay, now think about what happens if we do this badly. If we do the subtitles badly, and this happens all the time, you'll read them, even if it's in your own language, like you're watching, in my case, English, and you read English subtitles, you'll see at the bottom something and you'll go, that's odd, that's not what the guy said. Like, it's just not the same words. And the reason for that is, of course, they're trying to shorten how many words will appear on the screen, because they can only show the words during my shot. When they cut back to your shot, they now have to have what you're saying, right? So if I'm speaking quickly, they're going to have to kind of abbreviate what I said and just kind of make it. And, you know, there's how many so much you can words you can read on the screen. Okay, so that's disrespectful to the writer who went to a lot of trouble to pick what dialogue I would say. But it's just odd if it's wrong, right? It's like, that doesn't match. And then if we do a bad dub, as you said before, like it's that kind of funny thing that you watch a dubbed movie and it's like, we shall now go to the cinema. And it's like, you know, that's just funny, right? And people have parodied that in many forms. Like there's a whole sequence in Austin Powers when they do that. It's just funny. But if we do neural rendering and change my face to give a different performance in a different language and we do it badly, you think I can't act. You don't think it's technically wrong because you really can't tell that I've done it. So you just think that I'm not a good actor, or at least you think my acting is insincere, right? You might think it doesn't really look like Mike lost his son, doesn't really look like Mike's upset going to war. And so you sort of discount my performance. So that's really dangerous. The other thing, of course, is it's disrespectful to the actor at a fundamental level. Like that's their livelihood. It's also disrespectful from a whole different point of view, which is imagine you're thinking about the director for a second, right? And I give you a line, which is, I really need a cup of coffee right now. Yeah, that's the line. It's written by the scriptwriter as that. Now let's imagine that we're using the dubbed version and we're going to try and put that into some other language. Well, you're going to have to try and change that to make the words fit the visemes that the guy's doing. So if in a different language that's of different length or whatever, you're going to hack the language just so that it matches, which is disrespectful to the scriptwriter. But even if you didn't do that, right, even if you somehow magically just put it in and ignored the fact that the lips are moving wrong, it's like a problem of emphasis, because the actor may say, I really need a coffee right now, right? Or it might be, I need a coffee right now, right? And that's emphasizing different parts of the sentence. Now, of course, that's the actor's choice, right? It's the actor's, like what he's making acting choices about what he's trying to communicate, and or she. And so he or she might be choosing that that line is most about my needs, or in the other version, the right now bit, right, about the timing of it, like because they've been waiting in a restaurant for a long time. But if you change languages, the timing where that key word falls in the sentence shifts. So like if you're doing Korean, for example, it might be that the right now bit, the now at the end, just doesn't fall at the end of the sentence because of the constructs of Korean. But the actor is emphasizing the end of the sentence in one language and made to emphasize a different word in the sequence, if that makes sense, because you've changed the language. And so the word that they thought they were emphasizing, that's they've dubbed and said earlier. So when we're doing it, we're trying to be very aware of this so that we actually maintain the actor's intent, the director's intent, and the scriptwriter's intent, that we don't hack the language just to fit, that we don't change the way that it's delivered to match what they were doing before, though we're very respectful to the previous performance. What we're trying to do is blend the two and allow that new acting intent to be in sympathy with the original acting intent. Now, of course, the person that's doing the actual, you know, voiceover knows what's going on. The director knows what's going on and the actors know what's going on. So we can do all that, right? It's just that the technology hadn't allowed us to do that. We know what we want to do, but previously we just were constrained by trying to make it look either not odd or not funny. And it just hacked all of those people's. And I think this is a really good lesson generally for AI, that when we're thinking about AI, a lot of people say, oh, you know, what's the ethics or what's the copyright or what's the legal this? And I'm like, as my yardstick, we should just use respect. Like, are you respecting those creatives and their intent? And if we can do all of that, if you're respecting the artist that did the concept art, if you're respecting the artist that's doing the digital comping, if you're respecting the artist that is the actor, then you're doing the right thing. And that should be our sort of North Star. And so we went to a lot of trouble to do that. Now, in doing that, you sometimes actually create more work for yourself. So in the process that we came up with in that case of the champion, the tech engine for that is by the guys at Pinscreen and my good friend Hal Lee's company, right? And so when Adapt is producing that, they said to us, you know, what are your recommendations of how to do it? And we came up with this idea that instead of trying to be all disruptive and blowing everyone out of the water with like, hey, this is a whole new way of going. And, you know, you should all like forget everything you've done before. And it should all just be this amazing new tech. And aren't we clever? We flipped it the other way and said, how can we do this in a way that's the least disruptive to the technical people involved in the process? And our solution to that was to have nothing done on set at all for the process. So if you're the actor on set, you don't have to wear dots, you don't have to have a camera, you don't have to record special lines, we don't hold a grey ball in front of your face in between every line, we do nothing. You just give us the finished film with your performance the way you want it, cut the way you want, with no consideration at all to the technology. And you might think, well, that's dumb, right? We could make a, you know, so much easier on ourselves if we just got you to do a few things. And the answer is, well, yeah, we could. But I use this example, and sorry to go on so much, but I'm really passionate about this. We'd use this example. I was talking to this really great cinematographer, and when digital cinematography first came out, and I asked him what he thought about digital cinematography. And this is a Academy Award-winning cinematographer. I was lucky enough to be at this event with him, but it was a kind of cocktail party, and I thought I could just get, you know, this great conversation going with him about the tech of this. And I was Mr. Tech, right? Like I understood, you know, CMOS chips and how the dyes and the, you know, affected the matrixing to get to the color space. And I was like all ready for this discussion about dynamic range and whether or not, you know, like the low light properties would, you know, all of this stuff. And I'm all primed because this guy is like, you know, one of my heroes cinematography wise. And I said, so what do you think of digital cinematography? And he went, oh, I love it. And I was thinking, awesome, we're gonna have this great discussion. And I said, so what do you like about it? And he said, we don't have to interrupt the actors to change the mag. And I was like, of course. Like if you're a really good cinematographer, what matters to you is that you're not stopping the actor by having to change the film magazines. What matters to you is that they can roll and stay in the moment. You're not going to get in their face. And I'm like, that is the lesson for me. And so I really, you know, took that to heart. And so if we don't interrupt the process of the creatives doing stuff when they're making their film, yes, it's harder for us technically. In this case, we don't have much training data. That's the problem, right? We'd love to have lots of training data. So if you're the lead actor in this, Gone with the Wind Part 3, and, you know, it'd be great to have all this training data on you, but we were doing shots in The Champion that were like only 22 frames long. So we had 22 frames of training data on that shot. much harder to do than normal, but the actor who was giving an incredible performance, because it's a true story of the first, one of the first members of the Polish community that went to Auschwitz in the Second World War, and he was a boxer. So this is a true story. It's an incredibly serious film, and it's just, you know, heartbreaking stuff, right? This is just horrendous kind of historical account of what happened. And there's no way that he, as a absolutely brilliant Polish actor, should have had to have his process disrupted by us coming in with all our stupid tech, right? So I just generally like take that attitude. This we are in this golden age of machine learning, this absolutely brilliant explosion of machine learning, but we can't get, and I'm at the forefront of advocating it, but we can't get too caught up in doing that in a way that is sort of like a bull in a china shop. We have to do it in a way that supports the creatives and, just as I say, is respectful.
I really like the speech with the cinematographer, because I think we moan, you know, as compositors, you know, you get the footage in and you're like, why did they do it like that? Why did they do it like that? But we can eventually do it a lot, most of the time, within the budget. I mean, I would argue that if you want a lower budget production, maybe you have to accommodate the VFX a lot more if you want to have VFX in it. But at the end of the day, if they've got the resources to do it, then you can just kind of work your way through it. And if that is going to make the performances better and the acting better, it's going to be a better movie overall.
Yeah, I mean, this is absolutely the case. And also, I do sympathize because, I mean, obviously, my heart is as a compositor. There are times where you go like, this is just mad, right? Like we've all had those shots, right? Where they, I had one where somebody was lifting up a person on a chair and they wanted the chair to have rods to help lift them up, right? So you can imagine this, like it's low shot, chair floats up in the air. You're looking up from underneath at the person in the chair, right? And they had a couple of rods with two blokes either side holding that so that they could lift the chair. The only other way to do it, of course, would have cables from above. And so their idea to make this easier was to paint all of the underneath of the chair blue. And I was like, what? I was like, mate, it's like, all you want is the rods to go away. You've now colored all of the legs of the chair, which we actually want in the shot. And also, just coloring everything blue doesn't like solve it. But as a naive kind of onset team, they just thought, yeah, VFX, blue screen, let's paint it all blue. That'll help them. And I was like, are you mad? So like, obviously there are occasions where like, it's just bananas, right? You're like, just, you guys have no understanding of modern filmmaking if you think that's how we need to do things. Let me just get out of the, there you go. But the flip side of that is the number of times it's been invaluable to have really good reference from onset, even though you're going to replace stuff digitally. And that's not a mistake. That's a deliberate decision that people have done. And I've been on set with actors trying to like get a really good performance. And that's the thing that people remember, right? Like the how much they connected with the characters, how much they connected with the story. And it's not possible for us to fix that in post. Like if you've got bad acting, you can improve it with editing. But at the end of the day, like if you just have a woeful attempt at someone to look sad, you know, it's like really hard to fix that. So yeah, it's pick your battles, I guess.
And to be honest, when the acting is bad, the audience begins to judge everything more harshly just as a consequence. So your same VFX shot, if there's a good acting performance, no one will notice the flaws. They'll be just captivated by this personality. But if this actor is boring them or just not convincing, then the actor seems fake, and then they start looking around and they go, well, the background looks fake and this looks fake and that looks fake, and suddenly it's like being flagged as the effects are terrible as well, and it could be the exact same effects.
I gotta say, this is a point that I get to when people are discussing the metaverse. People often talk about the metaverse and they sort of go off on tangents about VR and all this kind of stuff. And I've done a lot of hardcore VR research, like really proper cutting edge. We had like 9 people running the back of house to get the VR stuff to work really well. So I'm not that I'm adverse to it from a technical point of view, but they do make this underlying mistake, which is more tech better. And even though they might say they might say out loud, oh yeah, no, we're not about the tech. Really, like if there's more tech there, they're happier. But here's the thing, like what you really want is somebody to totally get engaged and lean into what you're doing, right? You want them to be just really connecting with the material and having like an emotional engagement with it. Well, I don't know if you ever watched the TV show Survivor. But in the TV show Survivor, yeah. Right, like they get, they're on an island and, you know, they get to compete. Basically, it's a reality show, right? And so they're on the island for 32 days and every week they vote somebody off and you end up with less and less survivors until one person is crowned best survivor. Okay. But they're isolated and they are living in a shack that they built out of palm leaves and they're eating rice and trying to catch fish. It's pretty hardcore, right? So they're really run down. But here's the thing, about 2/3 of the way through the show, each season, they have letters from home. So if you're still on the show and you win whatever contest is the contest of the week on, you know, balancing a coconut on your ass, you get to get a letter from home. And you watch these people and they open these letters and they are reading, you know, what their mother, their wife, their child has said to them. And they're crying and they're like completely overcome with emotion. And the thing is, no one could tell me in a pink fit that they are not engaged with that letter. They are completely engaged. There's 100% emotionally. I couldn't imagine somebody more engrossed in something. And this is the lowest tech communication we have. It's a piece of paper with pen ink on it, right? And so they are not overwhelmed with emotion and completely consumed and just 100% engaged because of any tech. It's just the letter. And so by the converse, I don't know if you've ever been in a meeting where you're face to face with lots of people, but two people in the room have got their phones out and are kind of doing something and they're completely not present in the meeting, right? So it's just a fallacy to think that more tech is better when it comes to what we do with visual effects. It's not like it feels like if you could just put more tech in it, we'd be better, or it'd be a bigger shot, or it'd be a more complicated shot, or whatever. But honestly, I think the thing that's overrated is people saying, I want to do this effect shot so the audience won't know how it was done. And I'm reminded of a comment that Harrison Ford made at the beginning of his career. Like, Harrison Ford was going to see a casting guy, and the casting guy was, "Hey, Ford, you're like no good. Get out of the industry, kid. You're like, you're never going to have a career in this town. You're crap." And he then points to this thing. He goes, "This is Tony Curtis's first film role. He's a bellhop. He walks into the room. He's just a bellhop. And you can tell that that guy's a movie star. He has it. He's a movie star. You don't have that. You, the second this guy enters the screen, you go, that's a movie star." And Harrison Ford looks at this guy and goes, "Because I thought you were meant to think he was a bellhop." And I'm like, yes. Do you know what I mean? Like if the audience is going, how did they do that shot? They're just totally not in the movie. They're now out of the movie thinking about the production, and they're thinking about cameras, and they're thinking about logistics, and they're just not in the movie. I mean, my most difficult job is when I review visual effects films, and the visual effects film is so good that I forget to look at the visual effects, you know what I mean? Yeah. And it's easy to criticize a bad visual effects film, because if the film is bad, you can pay lots of attention to the visual effects because you've got nothing else to do because you're kind of bored, right? I remember there were some Bond films where I'd be like, okay, we're now into second unit doing a chase sequence. I wonder how long that's going to run for. I guess a couple of minutes. And then it's not going to advance the plot. It's just going to be this whole thing. And when it's over, we'll get back to the... It's almost like a bottle sequence. Like, it could go anywhere in the film. It's just Bond doing Bond stuff for 4 minutes and then we'll get back to it. And it's like, and the better Bond films doesn't do that at all. The better Bond films, you're like, oh my god, I'm really worried about the girl or the thing or whatever. Are they going to kill Judi Dench? And you know, and then you go, oh my god, that was amazing how they did that. I didn't even think about the fact that that Aston Martin was 3D printed. So yeah, it happens in all films, but yeah, I definitely think for visual effects artists, it's a crutch to just think more tech better.
Yeah, I mean, there's always the advantage of you're being asked to push the bar, and so anything that helps you push the bar, and obviously we have one specific job, right? So whether it makes the film better or not, our job is to deliver a better comp or a better effects sim. That may be completely pointless in the wider context of the story, but on the other hand, it is good to focus on doing your task well and successfully.
Yeah, I mean, you've seen Everything Everywhere All at Once, right?
Yeah.
It's just genius. That's five guys doing some of the best visual effects work ever. And why is it the best visual effects work ever? Because there's this kind of yardstick that I was at the Bake Off in LA for the Oscars. And I asked a friend of mine who's like won an Academy Award. I said, because I don't vote in the... I'm an Emmy member, but I'm not an Academy member. But I was just there as his guest at the Bake Off. And I said, hey, so when you're voting, like, don't tell me who you're going to vote for, but like, what's your criteria? Excuse me. What's your criteria? Like, are you voting for like that it's original, or that it's, you know, the volume, like that it's, you know, the most incredible amount of work, or that it's the prettiest stuff, or it's the work, you know, what is the criteria? Because the Academy's criteria is it serves the story and it advances the craft. Now, that's great, but like, unpack advances the craft. Like, what is that? Does it have to be original and visual effects we've never seen before to win an Oscar? And so I asked him that, like, what's your criteria? And he came up with a brilliant answer, which was, I think it needs to encompass those things, but it needs to encompass the challenge. Like, how challenging was it? And once you introduce that, you then say, okay, the guys that did Everything Everywhere All at Once should have been an Oscar nominee, because the challenge for them was to create a metaverse with five guys, some of whom were just running on their Mac laptops. And they were like older Mac laptops than I have. And I have Mac laptops, iMacs, and studio systems, right? Like, I have like 3 or 4 times as much compute power on my setup than they had to make this feature film, which is now up for Best Picture. And they only had 5 of them, and they were doing it in COVID. And they came up with just genius stuff that was visually refreshing. I've never laughed out loud more over 2 rocks in my life, right? Now, was it better visual effects technically than Avatar? Absolutely not. And I'm not saying that Everything All at Once should win over Avatar, but I'm simply saying by the criteria of the challenge, they should have at least been in the Bake Off, if not in the nominee list. So once you get to the final, right? I mean, we can have a whole separate discussion about that. And I think Avatar had an enormous challenges themselves, right? Just on a bigger scale. But those five guys doing that, and they were guys, doing that film, just to me, is just exceptional VFX work. And they were definitely like doing whatever it took to get the shots done, but they weren't like just throwing more tech at the problem. They weren't like throwing money. They didn't have any money. So, and have you ever been on a VFX shoot? Because I've been on lots of them where it's just a clever trick. Do you know what I mean? Like you go, oh, we don't need to do that because when you go off that shot, we'll have a person cross and that'll hide the thing. Or like I used to always think that visual effects compositing was like a magic trick, right? Like I would always try and do the effect shot before it got to the effect shot. So by the time it got to the effect shot, you couldn't tell what was going on because we'd already done it by that stage. You know what I mean? Like if we're having a person comped, I wouldn't wait to the last second to comp them. I'd comp them much earlier so that you were totally embedded in the look and it never changed around the time of the effect shot. But a lot of that is inventiveness. And I think that is sometimes people are like, you know, you could just throw a lot of tech at this and make a digital person. Or, you know what, you could just shoot over their shoulder and you wouldn't notice. And you'd be like, oh, okay. Done.
Everything Everywhere All at Once, one of the guys that was on it on Twitter was doing the chef who was, you know, he's got the raccoon and he's had all these vegetables flipping in the air and he didn't have time to render them or he didn't have any elements because he had like more vegetables needed to fly in the air and he just quickly painted them in After Effects just with a paint tool, painted like a mushroom, really rubbish like paintings really, but like didn't matter because they were motion blurred flying through the air and it was done in, you know, less than, you know, 20 minutes or something like that, which is how you have to approach those kind of shots if you have to do a whole movie on your laptop.
Yeah, yeah. And it's fun, right? Like, I mean, the new Steven Spielberg film, Flabians or whatever it is, like, have you seen that one, the Spielberg film? Like, sort of slight spoiler, but anyway, he, you know, it's like semi-autobiographical. And so it has him as a kid making films with his mates, right? And the thing is, it looks really fake when he's doing the cowboy and Indians thing because they're sort of shooting, right? And obviously, when you're a kid, you don't have blanks and you don't have real guns. You just have toy guns. And of course, there are no muzzle flashes. And this is like decades before we could do it in After Effects. So like, it just looks really hokey, right? Like they're just, ooh, boom, bang, bang. And of course, even though if you had the sound effects, right, just nothing happens. And then he comes up with this idea and they play it and it's like really impressive. And there are like muzzle flashes and you're like, what? That looks so good. And then his father says to him in the car, like, how did you do that? And the character in the film says pinpricks. And he went and actually stuck a pin through the actual piece of Super 8 film where the gun was at that frame. And of course, that just let straight light come through for a frame where the gun was. And of course, you get a little flash where the muzzle of the gun is just from the white light coming from the projector through the actual piece of film. Now, this is not a very scalable thing, right? You couldn't do this with a feature film because you'd have to pinprick every release copy. But for a kid making a Super 8 film, it's just like a... Now, that's the kind of filmmaking that I certainly grew up with. Like I shot on film. I used to come up with, you know, like dumb stuff to make stuff come off. And it's some of the most, you know, stuff that I like the most. Now, sometimes it's physical, sometimes it's digital, but that kind of creative problem solving, that's just awesome. And that's also what I'm seeing now with AI. Like, it's not just this heuristic kind of thump. People often talk to me about machine learning and AI, and they say, oh, you know, like, how is this AI going to change? And I'm like, there isn't one AI. There's just a lot of applications of machine learning in new and inventive ways that when you hear it, you go, oh my God, that's just genius. Now, it's a lot more complicated than the pinprick through the piece of Super 8 film. But also, we're in this golden age right now. And a friend of mine who works at, God, I'm sounding like I'm name dropping a lot. Anyway, Andrew, who works at Weta, came up with this. I just want to not take credit for what is otherwise a brilliant anecdote. And I was talking to him about this new thing we came up with. And I'm like, hey, Andrew, won't this work? And now this has nothing to do with Weta's work, right? He's just talking to me as a friend. But I'm like, we've come up with this clever idea with machine learning. And it seems to me like this will work like really, really well. And it seems like so obvious, like hasn't somebody done this already? And like, it's kind of just genius. And won't that be exactly what you want? And isn't this like a perfect candidate? And Andrew goes, oh yeah, we're in the popcorn era. And I'm like, I'm sorry, what? And he's like, yeah, there are all these kernels that are going to pop. They just haven't popped yet, right? But like, they're so obvious that they're going to pop. And you just have to find out whether they're popped yet or not. But they haven't popped yet, pop them, because they're going to pop, right? And they're going to be great. And if it hasn't happened yet, go for it. Now, 5 years down the track, maybe 10, I don't know, whatever, will not be like this, right? It'll be really hard to find things that are immensely powerful, but were really easy to do in machine learning, because presumably most of the popcorn would have been popped, right? But right now, you can just go, hang on a second, there's a problem here. Couldn't we just use ML on this? And you'd be like, yep. Like, hasn't somebody done that yet? Nope. Well, let's do it. And you're like, let's go for it. So, you know, it's a great time to be doing stuff if you can be inventive and come up with, you know, as I say, like clever, not necessarily obvious ways of doing stuff that are kind of like tricks, but just take advantage of how good it is to infer a solution as opposed to model a solution.
Could you just break down the difference between inferring and modeling?
So I'll do it at two levels. At the analogy level that I use for like, because my like wife isn't in the industry, right? So when I'm talking to her friends, it's like I use very simple analogies. So that in my wife version of the story, it's like, hey, if you're a sculptor and you want to produce a person, you actually get clay out and make a thing that looks like them. And if you really want them to look like a person, you might then cast that clay thing and make a rubber mold, and then you would like make a sort of like a, you know, injection molded plastic person, which you would then either paint or somehow color so that you end up with a mannequin that looks like the person. Then you'd make a wig which would sit on the head, and you'd like make a dummy of the person, and it might look pretty good, right? And that's basically the Madame Tussauds, you know, waxwork version of making a person. It's physically making them and going all the way through. And if you're an artist, well, you don't do that, right? What you do is you look at somebody, or if you know them really well, you just have sort of in your head learnt what they look like, and then you just directly paint what they look like from that angle. And that's all you do, right? You go straight from learning what they look like to visually drawing or painting the final image. You don't produce a model of them, which you then turn until you get it to the right angle, and then you like have to physically make something, even though it might be not in shot. Like a wig obviously has hair at the back of the head, even though you never see it from the front. So if you think about it from a VFX machine learning 3D point of view, you could, if you're making a house, you could model it in 3D, and you could texture that and apply textures, and then you'd apply lighting, and then you'd render it. And so using the lighting equation and the render equation, you'd like understand how light bounces around the glass of the architectural model that you'd built, and you'd produce this really gorgeous image. Now, machine learning, what you do is you say, hey, machine, here's a whole lot of houses that have glass, and it just basically statistically profiles that in a way that allows it to then, when you say, now give me a glass house, a house with a lot of glass at the front, it goes, okay, and it knows that glass looks like this, and glass happens to have these patterns in it, which doesn't know what the patterns are. We know that they're refraction, but it just knows when it saw glass houses with glass windows, there was, you know, refraction, and it had all these kind of interesting properties that we like visually, so that we took photos of them. And as they appear statistically a lot in the pictures, when I infer the new picture, I'll include those, because for all I know, that is glass, because the computer doesn't have any concept of glass. It just knows that in the pixels that it's referring to, there were all of these caustics things. But of course, it doesn't know it's caustics. It just knows that that's what it looked like. And so, of course, when it produces it, it just puts the caustics in. Now, we're all like stunned. We're like, oh my God, it did the glass and the caustics on the ground. And the computer's almost like, did you not want those? Like, aren't they glass? And you're like, no, no, that's caustics. And it's like, I don't know what caustics are. I don't know what glass is. I just know that all the pictures that you showed me had these swirly things in them, so I included those in the final image. But we're all staggered that it got the caustics in there, right? Because in the old model, you didn't get caustics for free. You had to, like, go to advanced ray tracing to get the caustics. And even then, it wasn't a sort of a given. So that's one aspect of it. The second aspect of it that's really important to understand is that the training in that process takes a long time. And to use my analogy again, it takes a long time for somebody to be able to draw from memory. Like if you say to somebody, draw me Barack Obama from memory, yeah, unless you're a very good artist and you've trained for a long period of time, you can't do that, right? Now, if you were to have something that you were matching one-to-one, maybe you'd have a pretty good shot, and you could even use old school techniques of like putting a grid in front of it so you could, you know, grid it up, or you could trace it, any number of things, right? But to do it from memory, that's hard, and it takes a lot of time. Similarly for the computer to infer that glass building, it takes a long time for it to train on the building, but it takes almost no time for it to actually do the building at the end. So once you've trained on it, the inference is super fast. And that's why VFX loves it, because as we enter a world with shorter and shorter production cycles and more virtual production generally, you want to be able to do fast stuff. But we don't have any problem. Well, we have somewhat of a problem, but not too much of a problem with spending time in pre-production, right? Like if we can do stuff in pre-production and prep stuff up, I don't mind if it takes 2 days. But when I'm sitting there with the director and I can do things in seconds, that's a good iterative loop time, and I can be productive. So it's brilliant for the different approach that it takes, and it's different also in its temporal aspects of workflow.
It's a really good breakdown. And of course, I mean, another thing that I've found just in production that I've actually had experience with is retimes. I mean, this is something that, you know, optical flow is, I mean, it works, but really a lot of optical flow retimes that are in production are a lot of paint work. And we had a job at one of the companies I was working at, an advert, a 30-second advert, and they were asked if they wanted a 40-second version, and they said they didn't. And then after they'd done the whole thing and they'd produced the whole thing, they said they did. It was all a one-shot, a one-er, all the way through. They ran it through this thing. It's actually an open-source tool, but someone's built a flame hook for it, and it worked. I mean, minimal paint work. I mean, there was some paint work. I won't say everything was like 100%, but they were able to just deliver in a very short amount of time the kind of thing that you would probably want to say no to with the previous tool set.
What was the plugin?
I can't remember off the top of my head. I will send you a link, and I'll put a link in the description of this.
The thing about it is, if you think about optical flow, it's trying to map between two frames, right? Like what was here in this frame, what was here in this frame, and then I'll do an intermediate version. And so if I'm standing in front of a black screen and I'm waving my arm over my head, that's super easy, right? Like Mike's arm was here, Mike's arm's there. Okay, it has to be halfway in between. I can optically put it halfway in between by optically flowing, because there's basically a whole stack of little vectors that are trying to do image matching between the two frames. Trouble is, you've got a chicken and egg problem, right? If I got my hands waving across each other, then it's like, well, in the next frame, is it that hand or was it that hand? Oh, I think it's the original hand. Oh, wait, now they've separated enough that I realize it was the other hand. And so you get that smearing and kind of popping effect where motion... Now, here's the thing, right? Think about it from a machine learning point of view. It learns on a whole lot of footage. It never saw the smeary stuff in real footage. Smeary stuff doesn't exist in the real world. So it's not likely to infer frames that have smeary stuff in it. It's just... It's like saying to it, use words you haven't learned yet as a child. It's like, I can't do that. I don't know what those words are. So the notion of what the training space is, like what are you providing the training space, is the magic or the art of machine learning. Understanding the relationship between the training data and the solution space that it provides. And so obviously when you're doing slowdowns, like slow-mo stuff, you don't get technical artifacts from the process in the same way, because it simply would not produce something that it's never seen before. And it's not quite that literal, but you know what I mean. But again, if you're coming from having done lots of retimes, which I used to do those all the time, I loved optical flow, then you kind of like jaw-dropped at how good it is when it doesn't produce those artifacts, until you think about it and you go, well, obviously, like why would it? Unless I'd shown it a lot of badly done optical flow, and then it would reproduce the optical flow errors perfectly for you, right? Because it would just assume that's what you wanted, because that's what you showed it as the example.
You can see the powers of the inference model spreading and more and more. I mean, even obviously the obvious one is Roto. We've all tried it. We've all tried, like, how can I see if I can get the machine learning to do all the Roto? What I found interesting on, for example, Rotobot, the plugin that's in Nuke, with the test, is we had a show, a letter for the king, and we didn't use it in final production, but while we were sending the first whips, we were using the Rotobot to produce Roto, while the Roto artists were actually doing Roto. What was interesting is it had clearly been trained in what humans look like, probably with leotards or something like that. So it knew, it seemed to get their arms and their heads perfectly well. But they had these flappy, raggy cloaks because it's a kind of medieval fantasy. And it just had no idea what to do with those rags. Those would clearly flip out. So you'd get this perfect Roto on a hand that you'd think would be really complicated. And then this awful mat on this bit of cloth.
Isn't it funny how you can't help but say to yourself, well, the hand would be hard and the cloth at the back would be easy. And then you're kind of frustrated when the computer doesn't see it that way. I get this all the time. Like, people anthropomorphize, of course, we won't have that discussion in 5 years, right? Because our expectation of easy and hard will be recalibrated by having 5 years of machine learning where we just understand what machines do well and what they don't. Having said that, I empathize completely with the issue. Like, it's one of the great jobs that a visual effects supervisor or a lead comp does is look at something and try and work out what's going to be hard, what's going to be easy, what are the best ways forward, just like imagining it ahead, right? And so when you get a new tech comes along and someone's like, how long is this going to take? And you go, I think it's going to be X. And then you go, actually, when I got into it, it was throwing up complete curveballs that I hadn't imagined. But of course, that'll settle down over time. But yeah, at the moment, it's a hard job doing breakdowns with machine learning because people are like, well, we haven't actually used this. I think like copycat and stuff in Nuke is amazing. But I think one of the things that blew people's minds when copycat first appeared and stuff is like the idea of synthetic data. It's the idea like you could have a comp and you're showing an edge that you're trying to get it to replicate. And then you just take that and then sort of effectively put it all over the screen in odd places. Just like total crap, right? And it's the same thing, but now rotated and twisted and just stuffed upside down and in the corner of the picture at different scales. And the machine goes, oh, that's really useful. And we all go, what? that's the most ridiculous. I can't believe that would help you. And the machines go, yeah, that's really helpful. Thanks. because, you know, it's just looking at pixels. And if you orientate the pixels or scale the pixels, it's more pixel information that it's getting effectively for training data, right? But yeah, it does your head in because you're like, surely that's not going to help. That's just like a 6-year-old sort of stamping their foot in the Nuke suite and producing crap. But the machine's like, no, that's quite helpful. Thank you.
That's a good tip as well, actually, that you can just like rotate and scale the same, you know, the same frames and give it a bit more information that way.
Oh yeah. Well, if you're doing sort of hardcore machine learning, and this is probably beyond what you want to know, but I'll tell you anyway. If you're doing like PyTorch or whatever stuff, there is actually like buttons for synthetic data. Like they're automatically built in because you take the training data set, especially with, well, image type work is what I do. And then you just like amplify it nine times, right? So it automatically flips stuff, rotates stuff, just, you know, varies it. And so if I've got like 1,000 images, I suddenly get 9,000 if I've got, you know, because it's just the synthetic amplification is just a natural part of ML. And that, as I say, is built into the libraries. Now, if you're doing that in like copycat or something, it's probably less obvious, but yeah, it's just getting used to the new, things that make a difference that are easy to do, like in blue screen, right? Or green screen. Like we learned, you know, oh, it's really easy to make a difference if you just put the darn green screen out of focus. Do you know what I mean? Like you don't have to have a perfect green screen in terms of little, but don't put it in focus. And then all of the darn wrinkles just go away and it's just like a better comp. And just make the actor take 2 steps forward and shallower depth of field and it's going to be a better comp. How easy is that, right? Took no time, no money. Yet when we first, you know, no doubt did green screens, or when people are learning to do green screens, they're like, don't know that, right? And they just have the actor stand, or it's either in focus or they stand too close for bounce light. And so the same thing with machine learning, just, you know, once people get more comfortable with more machine learning tools, they'll just know those little tricks that make it easy. people always assume that we're kind of static, and I always point out we're dynamic. And so what we know now is not what we... There's a thing in psychology. If you ask people like, hey, how much have you changed in the last 5 or 10 years? They go, oh, so much. Like I've... God, when I look back at me 10 years ago, God, I can't even believe, you know, like what I used to wear, what I used to do, what, you know, I just have changed so much. And they go, how much do you think you're going to change in the next 10 years? And they're like, oh, not much. No, I think I'm stable now. Like I've made my change effectively, right? At any point in your life, if that question is asked, you come up with the same answer, right? If you're like 65, you say, no, I'm about to retire. That's it. I'm not going to change much, right? And you'll do the same amount of change as you did when you're 20, relatively speaking, right? When you're like, oh my God, 10 years ago I was 10. Now I'm 20. But now I'm an adult. I'm not going to change much. So we always kind of assume that wherever we are now, this is it. This is kind of the stable point. And now it's all going to even out from here. And of course it isn't. Like it's all going to be continuing to change. And my wonderful original, you know, partner, Jeff, who's passed away, he just used to totally be into this. He used to have all these great quotes about change. He just loved how much things changed. Whereas almost everybody else I knew would be like, oh, I hate how this keeps changing, or I hate how I have to keep learning stuff, or if things could just stop. And Jeff was like, no, everything's going to change. And we want it to, and it's the best thing in the world.
It's a brilliant comment. And I tribute to Jeff as well that, you know, we've got him sort of mentioned in the podcast. I think it's a really important part of FX PhD, and that we saw less. I think when we were watching the videos, we'd always see you and John a lot more, a lot less than Jeff. But I think he was a really big part of both FX Guide and FX PhD.
Mainly a part of FX Guide, if truth be told. Like he was less involved with PhD. Just like the majority of the credit for FX PhD per se goes to John Montgomery, right? Like John is the guy. But having said that, John would be the first to credit Jeff with just being, you know, brilliant and insanely great. Don't get me wrong, right? But I'm just saying, like, to give anyone credit on PhD, you've got to give John Montgomery credit.
Absolutely.
He's the guy.
He was they used to have those meetups in a pub. I met him in a pub in London very early. I'd really just started kind of comping and I'd been learning. I was really excited and everyone was there. And he told me about how he'd, you know, suffered burnout and then just stopped. Was watching the Tour de France and then kind of decided to do something completely different and then launched FX PhD from this rather strange moment of just watching the Tour de France, having decided I'm going to take a break from my flame op days and do something different. So this change is important and we've got to acknowledge it. Having said that, we change, and this kind of ties into an episode that I recorded previously, so it'll probably come out slightly before this one. We were talking about the no AI thing that's happened on ArtStation. And so what I guess, coming back to your early point about respect, is the data sets themselves and the inference, like, are they original? Like, how important is the originality or the ownership of the data set when it comes to then owning the inference of that data set?
I guess there's two levels. Like, at one level, I absolutely think that you should own your own data and you should have control over who uses your data and what you do. I completely support the artist. But I will say this, if you post stuff into an environment where it says this is publicly available for anyone to reference, then that's what they're going to do. And I think part of the problem is there was a naivety over what people were doing when they were giving their content to platform sites. Like platform sites, be it Facebook, be it YouTube, whatever, like they are making money from you by selling your data effectively, right? And in it, I'm sorry, but it's just naive to think that you can upload all these videos and all this stuff to a site, not be charged a cent, and somebody is going to provide that service and not somehow make money from it. And so there is a prevailing view, like, well, that's all mine. I'm like, well, okay, if it's all yours, don't give it away for free. And if you're going to give it away for free and provide it to a platform, then just be aware that's what you're doing. And then people are going to use that. Like, that is the price you pay for. So if I post a whole bunch of stuff to Facebook, the price I pay is not a monthly fee to Facebook. It's the fee of them using my data about me, my, heuristics, my whatever. So you can't have your cake and eat it too. So if I post, like we post a lot of stuff to FX Guide and we own it, we don't post all that stuff just free to every other site, because then they'd own it, right? Or at least they'd have, you know, you can't come to FX Guide and take our stuff because we own it and it's on our site. Now, if you scrape our site, then there are, you get into fair use. And if you get into fair use, you're now in a really interesting area, because here's the thing. If I was talking to you about a shot, right? Like imagine we're in a brilliant world where I'm lucky enough to have you as my my visual effects team, right? And I say to you, okay, this opening shot, what I'm looking at is, and I used this example the other day with somebody else, like it's a David Lynch shot in a Pixar style. Like I want like this Pixar-esque David Lynch shot, kind of out in the kind of canyons, wild kind of Arizona space, right? Okay, so in that sentence, unpack that, right? I've said Arizona and you're thinking, okay, well, I've seen shots of Arizona. Maybe you haven't been to Arizona, but you've definitely seen photos of it and you've got an idea what that looks like. David Lynch, so now I'm communicating camera angle, where the frame is, wide angle, low angle, blah, blah, blah. And Pixar, a particular style of 3D, you know, great high quality, blah, blah, blah. But you're referencing three different groups of stuff to get the visual picture of what I'm talking about. And we call that respectful. We don't call that disrespectful. It's not like people would say, oh my God, I can't believe. Mm. Like in the new Avatar film, I think it was one of the Bake Off films. They were, you know, quite openly and happily saying, oh, this shot, the robots are coming out of the thing. And it was a very like Terminator 2 reference. Now, in the case of Avatar, it's a director referencing his own work, right? So, but my point is, no one said, oh my God, I can't believe that you cheated, because it's a completely new shot in every respect. It's just at best an homage, and or you could just argue it's a really good digital shorthand, a verbal shorthand for what you want to digitally, right? So when I talk to you about that shot, the David Lynch Arizona Pixar thing, it's just shorthand and it lets you reference and build up a mental picture of what I'm talking about. And we do that all the time. And when I'm talking to scriptwriters, I remember talking to a scriptwriter, it's really good. And I was like, you know, I'm not a scriptwriter. I do write a lot, but I'm not a scriptwriter. And it's like the number one thing he would say to young scriptwriters is read lots of scripts. Just immerse yourself in scripts, because you learn from them and then you get better. But you don't steal from them. That would be wrong. But you definitely learn from them. So now let's move that into machine learning terms. Like, is it wrong that the machine looked at a lot of David Lynch films, looked at a lot of Pixar films, and looked at a lot of photos of Arizona to come up with an inferred image of what a Arizona outside exterior shot would look like if it was in a David Lynch style and a Pixar style? And most people would be like, well, but I'm like, that's totally what humans do. And we applaud it, right? We say, you know, if you want to be a good artist, go to the Louvre and sit there and look at all these great masters on the wall and just look at how they used light. Like anyone who's a lighting artist will tell you that they'll stand there in front of Monet's haystacks and go, oh my God, look at how you've got this color in the shadows. Like he's captured the bounce light and the tones in the shadows, and then and it's tempered with the sky colors influencing it. And a good lighting artist will look at the haystack shot by Monet and just totally learn about how that produces really beautiful shadows and lighting things. And they're not stealing from Monet, and they're not being disrespectful to Monet in doing that. So I don't think it's a simple answer. I do, as I say, think that you shouldn't have your work taken from you and used commercially without your permission. But if you go and post a ton of stuff to a platform site that's going to make money from that, and they don't charge you, and you know it's not like a, then you're kind of like, well, what did you think that they were going to do? You know what I mean? Like, these are not charities. These are like commercial mega corporations.
There's an element of the terms and conditions, these very long terms and conditions that can be quite confusing, and we have had cases where people, you know, have been refunded on missold. In England, you get phoned up all the time if you've been missold PPE, which was this payment protection insurance that a lot of the credit card companies sort of upsold to customers. And even though people signed for that and agreed to it, the fundamental law was that they would be refunded on that because it was not what they expected it to be, because people might expect their image to be appearing in different places, but they might not expect their entire style to be taken.
Yeah, but that's the point though, isn't it? The current laws discuss taking your material and directly using it. The current laws, be them right or wrong, do not give you copyright over a style. If I come up with a new style, like there's another example, right? It's maths. Like, you can't copyright maths. If I come up with an equation, you can't copyright that, right? The classic example was some dude worked out, I was like either tides or celestial charts or some darn thing back in the, you know, I'm talking like pre-World War II. And it was a lifetime thing to produce this book of stuff that every naval cadet had to buy because they needed it for doing, you know, old school navigation before there were satellites, right? And then some American guy just republished it all in America, and they couldn't sue him because it was just numbers, and numbers can't be copyrighted. And so the only thing that they could do is that the British Navy insisted on only buying the British version and not the American version, even though the American version was cheaper, because there was no law that stopped you doing that. So if I come up with a really great equation, it's just not under the law copyrightable. It's not possible for you to copyright style. It is wrong and unethical and disrespectful to impersonate somebody or to imitate their style as if to pass yourself off or your work off as theirs or even their involvement in your work, right? Don't get me wrong, I'm totally against any of that. But like, who hasn't stylistically done? And then there is homages, and then there's parodies. Like, it's a very complicated and nuanced area. I guess for me, I fall a bit more heavily in the stuff is going to be referenced. And also when you get to art, it gets even more complicated because people say, oh, well, that wasn't done by the artist. That was just created by them typing some crap into a stable diffusion program. And that's not art. And I'm like, Andy Warhol didn't produce a lot of Andy Warhols when he was making them at the factory in New York, right? He would get other people to actually make the Andy Warhols, the screen prints. And, you know, the manual dexterity of doing something isn't actually the criteria of art. So there are lots of instances where artists have other people make their art, especially sculptors. Sculptors will often commission the art, design the art, but they'll actually have a team of other people actually make the darn things. And so it's a romanticized view of art that the artist has an innate mechanical, physical ability to produce something that is intrinsically the art. That's not art, that's craft. You have a craft at being able to do something. Like, I might have the craft of being able to paint in a certain way. The art isn't the craft. They're two separate things. And the art is detached, which is why you have concept art, which is, and I mean by this, like a conceptual artist, right? In, you know, and why somebody might, like Duchamp back in, you know, early part of the 20th century, does the urinal, for example, right? Which is like the ready-mades. And he does a bicycle wheel on a stool, and like, now where's the manual dexterity in that, or where is the craft in that? It's like there's no craft in them. He signs the urinal and sticks it on a, and it's so, I mean, it's like one of the most valuable pieces of modern art, right? It's extraordinarily, it's not because it's artistically exceptional, and it's not because there was a lot of craft in it. It's the concept of the ready-made and seeing art in everyday items that is the artistic component of that, which is also the artistic component of a Campbell's Soup by Warhol. And you go to Jackson Pollock and you're like, the guy is some drunk throwing paint at a canvas. How can that be anything, right? In Australia, we bought Blue Poles in like the 1970s. That piece of art, like I'm going to say late 70s, for like about $1 million. Today, it's worth like $500 million.
reading the argument, which is both my previous guest Alvaro Garcia Martinez and also the legal case that's being put forward, like Carlo Ortiz and some other people, and reading some of the case document, their description of stable diffusion is as a digital collage. So they're looking at it as being very similar to a DMP artist who might be taking pictures off the internet, but if they're freed for commercial use, that's one thing. But if they're not, you would still be in breach of copyright potentially, even though you are obviously completely changing that image because you're taking this mountain and it's no longer this photo of the Alps, but it's a fantasy mountain in Middle Earth.
So collage is a valid form of art.
Of course.
And under copyright laws, a significantly, I've forgotten the exact word, it's like transformed or transformative piece of stuff is a separate copyright and separate art, which otherwise, if you didn't have that, you couldn't sample in music. So there's just two issues here, right? Like, is it fair? Is it legal? And I'm not a lawyer, so I can't comment on the legality of it. I don't know that the law is always in sync with my opinion of what the law should do, but I totally respect the law. The question is the work that we're discussing respectful to the artist? And in some cases it isn't, and in many cases it is. But, you know, I just have a personal opinion, and my personal opinion is that you need to be respectful to the artist, but at some point also you can't throttle artistic processes by saying nobody can reference previous art. Like, that would be horrendous to, if you had a legal impediment to people referencing other people's art, that would be a horrendous impediment to the advancement of art, full stop. Just horrendous, right? It's like, look, I tell you, the same thing is, you know, when computers came out, secretaries lost their jobs in one sense, right? Because you just needed a secretary to type stuff up, right? Like, it's really miserable if you're the secretary, but the advantages as a whole were huge. So it's really crap if you aren't making money off people that are referencing your art. Like, I wish that you were making money off them, but it may be that the price of fixing that is actually, for me, a societal price too high to pay. In other words, if we were to fix the problem that everybody got paid for anyone referencing their art, while I see at the individual level, that might be good for the individual, it would be horrendous for society. But I don't want people just to be ripped off in their work and people to pass off, work as like somebody else's work or devalue their work. But at the end of the day, what makes something valuable isn't just, as I say, like the kind of the making of it. That's not what, like, art is different from craft. I just keep coming back to that.
Absolutely. And the other thing, this is rolling back quite a way, but I picked it up, and then obviously we had a lot of interesting discussions on a slightly different point, but you mentioned VR, and obviously your role in VR as well, and your role in MetaHumans, and about the more tech is better. And I don't know if you saw this demo. Did you ever see the Walmart demo of their Metaverse implementation? But there was some...
I don't think so.
So it's a digital shopping, replacing a website shopping, basically, your online shopping. Although, weirdly, at the end, it says, we'll pack the stuff into your car, which means presumably this person is doing the VR of Walmart from the Walmart car park, which seems like a bizarre choice. But you walk around the Walmart, and it had lots of things that I just thought were... For example, you would pick up the milk, and you would put it in your trolley. So you'd put your virtual milk in your virtual trolley. And if you just changed your mind, you actually had to take the virtual milk out of your trolley and put it back into the virtual fridge. Whereas you're thinking, well, I'm in a virtual world. Why can't I just throw it to the side? I mean, you're making it, you're giving me this slow digital technology. But at the same time, I've got all of the disadvantages of actually being in Walmart. I can't just throw the milk away when I don't want it. I have to put it back in the fridge carefully via this VR. And it just seemed, I don't know, there are you can sort of see what use cases there are, all the kind of virtual meetings where you have people in a meeting room, but they're looking at a PowerPoint presentation. And then you're wondering why are they doing that?
I mean, I'm 100% with you, right? Like, but the problem that highlights, isn't it, I believe, is that when people are trying to come up with things to do with new tech, they just tend to extrapolate from where they are right now. So if you looked at the first sort of movie TV show stuff that were based on radio plays, it was like, hey, the radio play is the thing that works, and so we're going to add vision, so we're almost going to effectively film the radio play, right? And if we're going to, or we'll put, you know, like they used to call them like the, whatever it was, the Colgate Theatre, because they were like, well, we've gone from the theatre to television, so we should just have a, you know, in their case, a televised theatre. And then we did the same thing with digital. Like, it was like, oh, well, we're going to digitize this process. So what we're going to do is take the brochure that you used to make and put it online. And now you'll have an online brochure. And, you know, what are you going to use a computer for? Well, you'll have a cookbook electronically, and you'll have your computer in the kitchen. And then you'll be able to, you know, go off the cooking instructions on your computer, which is just mad, right? Because back in the day, computers cost a bomb and they were enormous, and you're never going to put one in a kitchen. And, you know, like setting up a computer would take somebody like a half an hour. And the thought that you would dismantle your Apple IIe and lug it into your kitchen and sort of switch it all on and then like run the risk of it getting wet is just absurd, right? But that's what people do, right? And so the internet comes along, they do the same thing again, like with, you know, and every time something comes up, like VR technology, they're like, well, what's an existing thing? And we'll make a digital version of it. And that's always not what it's good at. So you didn't make money from making a digital book. I mean, some people did, right? But like, that wasn't the purpose of the internet. Why the internet blew up and went insanely and made billionaires was from platforms. Like, I'm not going to make any videos. Like, web TV came along, I think from Microsoft, and died when they were going to basically make a TV channel on the web. And nobody wanted to do that, right? It just didn't work. But YouTube comes along and says, we're not going to make any content. We're just going to let you upload your videos to this site, but we're just going to give a platform. And now it's the second most viewed website in the world and obviously one of the most valuable properties in the internet. Now, of course, you know, over time, YouTube people may make YouTube videos, but like it's a minor part of their business, right? So with the VR stuff and with AR, a lot of this stuff happens. Like, say, your example of Walmart, it's just mad, right? It's just nuts. The only reason that you might want to do something like that is if the people that you're initially trying to appeal to are so technologically inept that they would have trouble with a different mental model. So when we're doing user interface design, we often talk about what is my mental model as the designer and what is my user's mental model? And I need to have a matching mental model. And so if my mental model is Amazon, where you just delete something out of your cart when you don't need it anymore, and they can have that mental model easily understood, then they just delete it out of their cart and the milk is back in the notional digital fridge, right? But if they can't get that concept, and they can't have that mental model, then you have to go to the only model that they can work with, which is a traditional cart in a traditional Walmart, and then they put it back on the shelf. Now, I think that is probably why they did that, but I have no basis in fact for saying that. But if it is the case, then you're really assuming that your potential Walmart shopper is a moron, right? Because in the modern world, who the heck doesn't understand deleting something from the cart doesn't, you know, and it's digital inventory anyway, right? Like, but you know,
maybe they just thought it was more impressive to put it back in the fridge. In some ways, it's more.
And they couldn't think
impressive.
It was more impressive. Like, if they are, they're again morons, right? Like, it's just ridiculously stupid. But trying to make digital versions or virtual versions of what you've done already is just the most obvious way to make dumb new things. Like, that's just not what tends to work. You know, like it's just. It's a new angle, a new thing, a new possibility, a new convenience, not just replicating what we did. And it seems so obvious when you say it out loud, but, you know, it'd be the equivalent of when we introduced non-linear editing, like in Avid days, that you would have a little digital cutter that would cut the digital film, and then you'd have But having said that, you know, when Avid came out, they had bins, which is what you used to have for hanging up bits of film in. That was just, I think, as I say, trying to connect a mental model that you'd understand what it was. But the physicality of it, trying to mirror that, is nuts. Yeah, it's not the thing that you want. You want to have the new opportunities, and you need to think about the affordances granted by the environment that you're in and the possibilities, the potentials that that offers to the user, rather than recreating stuff from the past or from a physical world. I will point out all this. So the AI stuff that we've been discussing and that I'm, you know, kind of keen on, like, a really big aspect about that is it's not digitization. If you want to ask yourself whether the AI stuff is hype or not, and it isn't, but if you want to ask yourself that, it's the same question I always ask about stuff. Is this a digitization of something that we did before, or is it something new? And you can't say that the machine learning stuff is a digitization. It's actually a new thing. So it's potentially very, very powerful. Just digitizing a process is what we've been doing for the last 30 years, taking something and making it digital, right? I no longer have to have a actual ticket from the ticket machine when I go into the car park, because it just looks at my number plate and then I have a digital ticket effectively, right? That's a digitization of a process. Now, it might use machine learning to read my number plate, but that's not the point. It's just a digitization. It's just, there used to be a physical ticket, now there's a digital ticket. I've digitized the process. What we're doing with machine learning, when we're coming up with some of these things, well, like in my case of the champion that we did with Adapt and Pinscreen, like, that's not a digitizing of the film process. The film process is already digital, right? The dubbing, you know, we already involved digital sound files. That's not digitizing it. It is actually changing something. Ergo, it's new, and therefore it's got legs and has real potential. Some things may wither on the vine still. That's not, you know, say everything that's AI is going to work, but it's not just an incremental, if you like, digitization process. And so digitizing walking around a supermarket with a trolley just doesn't get me out of bed.
No, but you can see shops where it would make sense, where a clothes shop, where if you had a scan model of yourself, you could actually see what you look like in the various clothes. Or if you had an IKEA and you had a digital model of your house, and you could put the furniture in your digital house without having to take it home and build it, those would be kind of useful things that might add something to the experience. Because
there's enormous benefit in digital clothes, right? You could, if you're buying online, it's the size problem, right? The economics of digital humans in fashion is enormous, and part of it is just reducing returns. So if I, which is the case with some apps already, right, I can see a pair of shoes and I can just point them at my own feet and it'll show me what they would look like on my feet, right? And then Yo-Yo Town in Japan and stuff does amazing stuff with, like, being able to digitize your own feet and yourself so that you can get exactly the right sizes. And all of that is financially viable because they just reduce returns. And in the fashion industry, returns is incredibly expensive cost of doing business. They have to have returns or you won't buy online, but, like, it's just dead. It's dead for shipping. It's dead for what happens when that inventory gets back, whether they can reuse it or not. I know stories of people buying TVs and they were faulty and they were like, well, I would like a new one. They're like, sure, we'll send you a new one. And they're like, do you want this one back? And they're like, no. Because what are we going to do with it? We're going to pay you to ship it to us, and then what are we going to do? It's faulty. We're going to just throw it out, and then we have to pay to throw it out. So we'd much prefer you just to keep it. And that, to me, is insane, right? But think about the cost if that's not a faulty thing, but just something I don't like because it doesn't fit. And so, yeah, the economics of, and also just the quality of materials, like knowing how they would flow, whether or not they hang or they like, I like shirts that are got a bit stiffer so that I don't like kind of a super low cotton thing. That's just my preference. I just think that it looks better on me. That's got nothing to do with anyone else. Just, well, maybe my wife, but, you know, apart from that, it's like, I just don't like it. So when I'm buying a shirt, it matters to me the weight of the fabric. It's very hard to tell that from a photo, but you can tell it when they actually have a photo of a real person. But I would love to be able to have, you know, more information about the weight and the structure of the material and how it would move. And you can't get that from a still. So yeah, there's a lot, but I would argue again, this is not digitization. It's not doing a digital, it's not a digital sort of parallel. It's actually providing something new that you couldn't otherwise do, which is I could understand the nature of a fabric while being 300 miles away from the fabric.
I mean, at that point, you're actually simming cloth on yourself, which is, you know, I mean, in terms of the level, the volume of customers you'd be doing. And this was another thing I was going to ask about, because it is the kind of connection perhaps between AI and some of the AR stuff is, economically, you know, metaverse is website money, but in order to be attractive, you're looking at like almost AA games in terms of the environments and so forth, and a lot of things that exist in AA games which cost a huge amount of money to produce, but at the same time you're looking at trying to create it at the cost of a website, maybe an expensive website if you're talking about Amazon. Maybe not so much if it's a local business.
So you're concerned about the economics of the metaverse, as in whether I can produce that level of quality at that. But I mean, I'm not a fan that there is going to be a metaverse that I go to, right? Like, I think that's not what the metaverse is. And I don't think that's what we're approaching. I think that's exactly what I was talking about before, which is some imagining of the current thing, then just moved into some digitized version of it. My metaverse is, I want a digital human / co-pilot / assistant that is with me in multiple locations and has memory. So it understands me, it understands where I've been and what I've done, and it contextualizes any response accordingly. And it doesn't just start from scratch when it asks any question. And I want to be able to do things that I can't do previously in a digital twinning sense, not in a going into some virtual poker room to play poker with my virtual friends, which is sort of the demo I think that they had at Meta. And now Meta does exceptionally good digital human work, don't get me wrong, they really got some of the best researchers in the world, really, really great. But some of their demos are just so dumbass in terms of like the conceptualization of that technology. I mean, no one in their right mind is going to go into some VR space with their mates all going into some VR space and play poker with them. Like, it's just almost the definition of being a loser, right? You're like sitting alone in your bedroom in your underpants, like in sticking a VR thing on, going to some, like, it's just not going to happen. And also, you know, yeah, and don't get me started, but what I do think is going to happen, and very, very soon, is that we're going to start having really interesting volumetric capture spaces. And so we'll be able to gather a whole lot of volumetric information using machine learning and other techniques, NERFs and other things, so that we can digitize where I am in a sense that then allows it to be volumized and done over time. And then the experience of that would be you would look at it on your iPhone or iPad, and as you move your iPhone or iPad, it moves the view. So I would, if I was a parent, I would do this of my kid's birthday party, and then the grandparents could watch that back. But if some child's in the way of seeing the candles being blown out, they would just move their head or their iPhone to the left, and they'd see around the child that was blocking the view, right? Now, that's sensible to me. And it's also a business model that's sensible, because everybody has mobile phones or iPads or whatever. And they could obviously be made by Google, but, you know, I'm just going to use that term. And they are going to be able to experience that way. They're not going to be spending an extra $1,200 buying goggles. They're just going to use whatever they already have, but experience it volumetrically. But there will be a whole new breed of VFX artists and people making those things. So like a store, a bike store, whatever, might have a whole lot of volumetric work done by a crew, which you'd normally call a video crew or a film crew, but that crew would make all of that volumetric stuff up for the company that would then allow Joe Consumer or Jane to come along and sort of experientially more reasonably understand the goods and what was going on in the store. And that's why I'm a big advocate of saying that really soon now, companies like Apple will release expensive tools for the volumetric capture and creation and stuff. But but they won't be making glasses, goggles, and VR headsets because that end of it just doesn't have legs, right? It's there are corporate applications of stuff, but Magic Leap, I mean, I had Magic Leap. I mean, I understood the technology, very excited about it because of its VR overlay potential. But still, like, it's just really unreasonable at the moment to expect people are going to go, oh, quick, run into the other room, get out all this kit, switch it on, calibrate it, run it, pop it in, unless it's entertainment at a like a venue or it's gaming, like hardcore gaming. Yeah, no problem, right? You can come up with some really good games that are like that. But leaving that aside for a second, you know, and I know one on a date with a partner wants to like have them sit in another chair, unable to see you with some goggles on. I mean, it's just nuts, right? But how cool would it be if you were second screening the Super Bowl and you on your phone could be zooming around and zooming in to see something because you were more interested in what was happening in your team than the coverage of the Super Bowl, which was showing you the main play from the obvious vantage point that was of interest to the majority of viewers. But on my second screen, I was able to, like, at the same time, zoom down in and, like, check out what was going on with the other team's, you know, blind side or whatever. I don't know American football well enough to give you a good example here, but in soccer, right, like, I might be interested in the in my goalkeeper and because I just think this guy's awesome, but the play's at the other end of the field and I'm just curious what's happening at the other end of the field, and that would be a good second screen experience for me to be able to do that. Now, you wouldn't don the headgear and all that stuff to do that. You'd simply, you know, and there are some other really good examples. There's a very new, hardly talked about short on Disney, only in America, where at various points in the short, and it has Blair Larson in, like, from, you know, plays Captain Marvel, but at various points in the thing, things come out of your screen. So if you're holding your iPhone up, pointing at your own telly, yeah, there's like a waterfall that spills out of the screen onto the floor of your own living room, right? And then trees start growing in your living room. Now, you only see that if you point your iPhone towards where the tree is. But like, how cool is that, right? So you're sitting there and the story's going on, but things are literally leaving the screen and flying around your living room. And that would completely match with how my daughters watch television, which they always have a TV show on that they want and their friggin' iPhones out at the same time. That's the VR metaverse that I'm interested in and I think is commercially viable. And that is technically and economically viable to do, to your point about AAA games, right? Because that tree growing and the waterfall coming out, and maybe it's, I'm watching, I don't know, Andor, which this isn't. That was reality. I'm now speculating. If I'm watching Andor season 3, that, you know, the jet fighters or whatever are in my room and then go over the top of my head and into the screen. Like, that would be super cool, right? And you can imagine really good surround sound on a home system where you'd hear that there was a tank off to the right and it's not on the screen yet. But if you had your second phone, you'd pan around to the right and say, oh my God, there's a tank coming from the left. I can see that, right? That's engaging, that's cool, that's interesting. And I think that'll be what the metaverse is. But it'll probably be called something not metaverse just to get over the stigma that'll be attached to annoying futurists talking about the metaverse in a way that causes us all to just feel kind of ill.
Brilliant. So I think this has been a great chance to speak to you finally and like get this and go through a lot of topics. There's actually quite a few more topics I'd want to start, but I think that could run into a whole other episode.
I think we're out of time.
Yeah. So is there anything you wanted to just say as a kind of wrap up, as in conclusion?
I guess there's only one point I would make, and it's really to sort of thank you and people that are doing this discussion. The thing about AI and a lot of the stuff with visual effects is that there are going to be bad uses of them and there are going to be disrespectful uses of them. The biggest tool we have in our arsenal to fight bad actors using this stuff is to have a really educated and literate population. So my lab, the Modus Lab at the University of Sydney, where we do research, we spend a lot of time doing what you almost saw like community outreach, not like your listeners are professionals, but beyond professionals, they're kind of like more just interested people in the community, because a lot of this stuff is really important that we discuss. And if we don't discuss it, people are going to either take advantage of people or just, you know, do things that are wrong. So it is really important that there be like an active conversation in these spaces. So that's why I was really keen to do the talk with you. The more that we can have these discussions and come to an agreement on what is the right behavior when using these new technologies, I think the better off we will be.
Fantastic. I think that's a really good place to close the discussion, and we'll look forward to seeing the reaction to this and seeing what's happening next. We'll put links in the description to everything we've discussed and a few more things. And thank you very much.